Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to XBN, the Sex Worker Rights Broadcast Network, a service of the Sex Workers Outreach Project East, SWOP East. You can find us at www.swopeast.org. My name is Jill Brenneman. We are, of course, powered by Blog Talk Radio. Today we have a scheduled guest. Her name is Maxine Dugan. She is a filmmaker, among other things. She has a film, Legalization Stop Decriminalized Now. It's available on DVD. The film premiered at Labor Fest 2005. The film features interviews with four sex workers who share their experiences and discuss labor and economic and human and civil rights that are now denied them as erotic laborers. Once again, my name is Jill Brenneman, and while we are awaiting our guest to arrive on the show, looking at the New York Post, more Spitzer-related allegations. Hints of Madam link to the D.C. Vixen. Berger seeks Senate scandal. It's amazing how this scandal just continues to make the headline news in New York. Now we're discussing a former Senate aide who scandalously, according to the New York Post, scandalously blogged about sleeping with a Washington D.C. elite escort for cash, who later posed nude for Playboy. You can get all of this on the New York Post. Of course, there are always the pictures of the scandalous women. Where is the topless picture of Elliot Spitzer? That is what I want to know. I would like to see the picture of Elliot Spitzer topless. That would be one riveting picture. We're still working through a technical snafu trying to get Maxine on the show. This is a new software program for us, powered by Blog Talk Radio, and thus we have a few technical problems. So Maxine is going to join us shortly. Yeah, I want to discuss a pet peeve while we're waiting for Maxine. I get this notice from my apartment complex. It says that dog owners are now responsible for picking up the pet waste of their dog. And I realize this is not a sex worker related question. It says excrement and the urine. Well, how does one pick up the urine of their dog? That's just a question I have not figured the answer out to yet. Okay, we're gonna try to pick up Maxine.
Can you hear me?
Maxine.
Are you there? Can you hear me?
Thank you for joining us, Maxine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. It sounds like you can't hear me. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Maxine.
Okay, cool. So we're talking about whose urine this morning?
I'm sorry?
Whose urine are we talking about this morning?
This morning, Maxine, we are talking about the new apartment complex rule and regulation, which states that pet owners must pick up both the excrement and the urine of their pets, and they must both do them in designated areas.
Oh, urine and excrement.
Urine and excrement.
How's that going to work?
You know, I mean, the excrement, I can understand, you know, I mean, you can pick it up, you can put it in an excrement special bag, but the urine, you know, we're in a drought here in Raleigh, Durham, so it dries up fast. It's really hard to figure out where the urine exactly is. I haven't gotten an answer yet. Maybe we can get my apartment manager. Maybe we can get the apartment complex manager on the phone to discuss this policy. My guest is Maxine Dugan. She did not call in to discuss with us dog urine. Maxine, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, it's early morning out here on the West Coast, and it's a beautiful, beautiful day, and we just had a fabulous weekend over at the Anarchist Book Fair here in San Francisco. You know, there's a lot of sex workers who are anarchists, as it turns out. And so we had a booth along with some of the industrial workers of the world and some other fabulous anarchists who are independent publishers and artists. And we collected a bunch of signatures. You know, we're on a signature collection drive to qualify a ballot initiative here in San Francisco to stop the enforcement of the prostitution laws and bring protection to sex workers. And so at the Anarchist Book Fair, I showed my movie, Legalization Sucks. And that's a movie that me and some of my friends made back in 2004. We were really freaked out because my son was being deployed to Baghdad. And we were so freaked out about it that we were just in conversation about, you know, our pitiful democracy here in this country and, you know, my son's being asked to go, you know, put his life on the line to bring democracy, you know, to another country when, you know, he, his own mother, you know, doesn't have any democracy, you know, right here in our own backyard.
He's being asked to fight for his country, for his democracy, and yet his mother can't get fair labor and civil rights.
That's right. And we were all, you know, we were all against the occupation of Iraq. And, you know, we all knew that the Bush administration had lied, you know, to the American people and that the American people are suckers anyway, you know. And so we were just completely outraged and wanted to respond, but yet we wanted to respond in a more localized way that brought attention to what exactly our situation was here, you know, in the sex worker rights movement. So, you know, at that time, I just had a bunch of friends who had worked in legalized sex industries, the Nevada brothel system and the San Francisco dance club. And as they were talking about their experience working in those legalized situations, you could see the commonalities that they all had. That they were all forced to sign these independent contractor contracts. Those contracts are all written by the owners of the establishments, written by the owners' lawyers, you know, that say the owners, you know, don't have to do anything and the workers have to do everything. In fact, the workers have to pay to work. The workers have to pay the owners to work there. So, you know, in the prostitutes rights movement, people always talk about, oh, if you just legalize it, it'll be okay, right? That's what they tell us, right, Jill?
And can clear out that that is not the case.
Right. So I made this movie with two gals that work in the Nevada brothel system and two gals that worked in the San Francisco dance clubs, and they talk about their legalized work situation and how the workers, you know, continue to be exploited just as in the criminalized situation, and that legalization is not what we're going for here. Legalization doesn't empower the workers, and we want some actions that are going to empower workers to be enfranchised in having access to our own right to negotiate for our own labor and our own work conditions. So,
Maxine, We picked up already one response via the chat blog, and someone is asking, what is the difference between legalization and decriminalization?
Oh, that's a great question. And the petition that we're circulating right now in San Francisco is decriminalizing prostitution. And how you do that is you stop the enforcement of the criminalization of prostitution laws. In other words, the petition mandates that the city of San Francisco no longer allot money towards the investigation and the prosecution of prostitutes or our customers. And in that, we see decriminalization, where you decriminalize an occupation. You know, and legalization has to do more with the idea that if you regulate a certain kind of work, like in the massage parlors, for example, here in San Francisco, the massage parlors are highly regulated. They used to be that you wanted to get a license, you had to go to the police department and put down your fingerprints and pay to put down your fingerprints for a background check and pass a test in order to be issued the right to work, to be issued a permit. And then in 2003, we saw the enactment of the administration of the permitting process for massage parlors and masseuses be regulated over to the Department of Public Health. Well, here now we find out 5 years later that the Department of Public Health has administered an additional whole layer of regulation onto the massage parlor workers. Some people may have been watching the MSNBC TV program called American Sex Slave, and it features some of the Asian massage parlors here in San Francisco, and it features the Department of Public Health, San Francisco Department of Public Health, going in and fining, laying down fines to massage parlors because the workers are not wearing clothing that doesn't cover their neck. And in this particular series, they show a Department of Public Health telling the manager of the Asian massage parlor that, you know, she's going to be paying a $5,000 fine. So what we're seeing here with regulation is, additionally now, workers, massage parlor workers have to go to San Francisco Police Department, lay down their fingerprints, pay for a background check, but now it's the Department of Public Health who has come in and added this additional level of regulation about what kind of clothing the workers can wear. And let me say that, go ahead.
What are they suggesting? Like a flight attendant scarf?
they want the workers to wear something that will cover their necks, apparently. It's just this ridiculousness kind of regulations that we see in legalized sex industries. That are being used as a means for the bosses to exploit the workers. In the case of the massage parlors, the bosses are the San Francisco Department of Public Health. It's essentially the city government, and the people who elect the city government, who now become the bosses of the worker and tell the worker what they can wear, what they can't wear, what the fines are going to be. So in San Francisco here, we have something called the Sunshine Ordinance, which is where you can go in and ask any question of any public department. So I went to the Department of Public Health, Jill, and I said, how much money in fines have you taken off massage parlor people since the inception of this additional layer of regulation through the Department of Public Health? And guess how much money they've taken off these people, Jill?
How much money have they taken, Maxie?
$71,000. $71,000 off of various massage parlor workers and operators in the last 5 years. $71,000. Yeah.
That's quite a revenue stream for that particular department.
Right, and that's what we see with legalization of sex industry workers or erotic laborers, is that, you know, when you want to implement these layers of regulation, you're not bringing any protection to the workers. these regulations are never worker-centered. They never empower workers on our jobs to be able to better negotiate for our labor and our work conditions. Regulations always cater to giving more of our money to the bosses.
Well, I don't know, Maxine. I mean, when I was a little girl growing up, my grandma always used to tell me to wear a scarf so I wouldn't catch a cold. Do you think it's a possibility the Department of Public Health is looking to fight influenza and the common cold?
It looks like the Department of Public Health in San Francisco is profiting and pimping off the erotic labor of workers, and the problem is that, you know, we have a right to catch a cold. We have the right to protect ourselves. And the fact is that, you know, all erotic laborers want to be able to protect ourselves, and we're the best ones to be able to say how it is that that's going to happen on our jobs. We don't need a daddy pimp Department of Public Health coming in and telling us how it is that we're going to protect ourselves. Now, mind you, Jill, there were stakeholder meetings that were held at the Department of Public Health where workers, massage parlor workers, and masseuses were able to come in and contribute to discussions around these regulations. And I was a part of those meetings. And I can tell you that in those discussions, you know, the Department of Public Health officials had already made up their mind about what regulations they wanted and about what kinds of questions were on the test. And so many of us who qualified to get licenses under this new layer of regulation have refused to get licenses or permits to operate because we completely object, you know, number one, to being identified, you know, as a masseuse because, you know, what if you're in a child custody case? And your custody for children are being disputed. You know, any inference of any impropriety can shift, you know, your relationship with your whole life and for your children's lives in a detrimental way when it's left into other people's hands. So many of us have just refused to participate in this bogus regulation and to be regulated. And, you know, that's why, you know, we advocate for complete decriminalization across the board. That is a complete repeal of all the prostitution laws on all levels, that we have to make even the playing field for workers to be able to be at the center of our own volition and of our own agency in how it is that we want to work and what's safe work conditions for us. We're big girls and boys. We can do it.
My name is Jill Brenneman. This is XVN, the Sex Worker Rights Broadcast Network. We are powered by Blog Talk Radio. With us is Maxine Dugan. If you would like to join in the conversation, God be with you, as it appears that Blog Talk Radio is having numerous technical problems this morning. But as of right now, you can join us at 646-200-3136 as the switchboard has come back on. Once again, that number is area code 646-200-3136. You can join Maxine and myself, at least as long as the Blog Talk Radio switchboard stays online. And Maxine, we have another via the Blog Talk Radio chat. We have someone who is asking about a program called SAGE, Standing Against Global Exploitation. Knowing you to the level I do, I would guess that you may have an opinion about that project.
Well, we named the SAGE project in our petition in our initiative bill to decriminalize prostitution and bringing protection to sex workers. I'm here in San Francisco, and one of the reasons the SAGE Project is named is because they are a party to the First Offender Prostitution Program, and The first offender prostitution program was concocted by the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. And interestingly enough, the first offender prostitution program was concocted back in the late 90s because we had a situation here, Jill, where the police would go in and run raids and sting operations and bust the prostitution solicitation on masseuses, you know, Asian massage parlors, private workers in our homes. And they would, the police would end up ultimately cutting a deal in terms of how much money the workers were going to be paying the police department. So we started getting wind of workers writing money orders, U.S. Postal money orders to the vice department. And in order to have their cases dropped, in order for the police to not turn over those citations they had written to the district attorney's office. So, you know, that's a little bit on the unethical side. And so we got the San Francisco Department or San Francisco Board of Supervisors to hold public hearings in the Budget and Finance Committee to make the police be transparent and accountable to how much money they were taking off the massage parlor workers. And of course, they could never find their money, you know, where the money had gone. Fortunately for us, workers had made copies of the postal money orders. So we were able to clearly see that, you know, the police had been involved in accepting monies from massage parlor workers in lieu of having their cases dropped. Now, typically, you know, paying off the police is not generally something that maybe people in our position who want to work are you know, against doing. But the point is that we shouldn't have to pay anybody for the right to work, whether you're paying the police department or you're paying the public health department or you're paying, you know, the dance club owner, you know, for the right to work. But unfortunately, the city of San Francisco took the situation of exploitation that the police were doing and decided that they were going to implement the first offender prostitution program because they knew that the sex worker rights activists were screaming and yelling, didn't want people arrested, didn't want people fined or, you know, being disenfranchised in any sort of way over because of working. So they came up, you know, Norma Hotelling, who had been running the SAGE project for a while, was looking for a way to have her project become linked with city services so she could get more money and she could get a steady stream of people who were arrested for prostitution mandated into her program so she could get paid. And so the scheme that they came up with, the scheme being by her, Norma Hotelling, and the district attorney's office, was that they, in arresting people, they would offer people through the district attorney's office the option of having a diversion program where you wouldn't be prosecuted and have a prostitution arrest or a prostitution conviction on your record. So you would just be mandated to go to the SAGE project and have to sit there for at least 6 hours, and you'd have to pay. And so that's what the diversion program looks like here in San Francisco. And we don't think that workers or our customers should be arrested. We don't think that they should be made to go sit in some shame-based, sex-negative class where they're yelled at and treated in a dehumanizing way by sex industry workers like Norma Hotelling, who have a negative view of her former occupation and, you know, dish that out under the city government's guise of diversion. So we named the First Offender Prostitution Program in our petition. And we say that, you know, that the San Francisco, you know, city agencies and law enforcement shall not, you know, be funded, you know, towards, you know, implementing any exit strategies or any, you know, any sort of you know, impunitive you know, re-education processes, you know, for sex workers. But that's not what we want our city monies going for. And, you know, when we have city agencies who are involved in doing those activities, who are getting paid to administer this shame-based sex-negative program called John School, called the First Offender Prostitution Program, those workers are in fact crossing off the criminalization of prostitution. You know, because those are decriminalized workers who work for the district attorney's office and who work at the SAGE project. They're not getting arrested for working on their job today. Their economy is not being threatened by being arrested and thrown in jail. So, but they are profiting and making money off of our criminalized labor, and we don't have the right to negotiate for our labor and our work conditions, and they do. And that's called an unfair business practice, and, you know, that's called exploitation of one class of workers of another. And it's wrong, and I think that the San Francisco voters are going to vote for this initiative when we get it on the ballot, and that they're going to agree that funding these first offender programs and having one group of workers profit off another group of workers' labor is something they don't want to be involved in.
Well, it almost sounds like stereotypical foreign country. You get the choice of an arrest, or you get the choice of being sent to the re-education camp, except you have to pay for the re-education camp also, and these business owners and governmental agencies are profiting financially, and they're giving the sex worker a no-win situation. You can go to jail, or you can go to the re-education camp and pay to be re-educated and told what your views should be. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Absolutely. You know, just this business of you know, exploiting workers whose occupation is criminalized is the same thing that we see going on in Guantanamo Bay, where, you know, a class of people have been picked up off, you know, one continent and transported to another continent, you know, and being coerced into a situation that, you know, they don't even have any legal rights. And that's what the diversion program in the First Offender Prostitution Program and all those diversion programs, ultimately they do, is they ask people who have rights, U.S. citizens who have rights, to give up your rights. Give up your right and we won't prosecute you. And that's how we, you know, that's how we treat other people in other countries, and it's coercive, it's dehumanizing, and, you know, U.S. taxpayers at the local and state level should not be involved in it, and the U.S. government and the U.S. taxpayers should not be involved in it, and we are involved in it. We are involved in it here at the local level in criminalizing and being violent towards a whole class of workers and our customers by arresting us and prosecuting us and threatening to prosecute us and suffer all the ends that comes with, just like, you know, we go and point a gun at Iraqi people and say, you know, you better do it, you better jump through this little hoop today, little monkey, or we're going to shoot you. You know, we're going to take your oil, we're going to define for you what rights that you have at the parliamentary level, what rights that women have. I mean, that's a big issue right now in Iraq. You know, here they're trying to put together this false democracy over there. It doesn't have anything in it for women. In fact, women have less rights and less access to their rights under the Bush administration than they did under Saddam Hussein. So, you know, meddling, when the U.S. comes in to meddle with a situation, it's always strictly for our own independent gains. It's never for the workers. It's never for bringing any sort of civil rights or advocacy or under this baloney of stopping violence. You know, the SAGE Project uses this line of arresting people and trafficking us and our customers into their first offender program as a means by which they are de-escalating violence when they in fact are the arm of the police state who are administering the violence on us and administering the coercion on us. and it's an unfair business practice, and they're profiting off it, and we're going to stop it.
You know, it reminds me, at Clarkers Outreach Project East has a colleague and a project in the country of Chile, and it reminds me of U.S. history in Chile. Many people may not know that in 1970, Chile democratically elected a communist candidate to be president of the country named Salvador Allende. And after 3 years of CIA meddling in Chile, getting the truck drivers union in their pocket to strike, to essentially make it impossible to buy food, the CIA backed a coup to restore the country, to bring food back to the Chilean people, according to the CIA and the U.S. government. And they placed in power Juan Augusto Pinochet, who was not legally elected. He was notorious for human rights violations. I'm not sure that he was big on re-education first offender programs. His model seemed to be more throw people in the river or bury them in a wall. However, that does seem to be typical involving the U.S. Maxine, joining us now on the listener line, we have a caller. Would you like to take a call?
Absolutely.
All right, and if anyone else likes calling, you can join us. Area code 646-200-3136. My name is Jill Brennan. This is XVN, a service of Sex Workers Outreach Project East, powered by Blog Talk Radio. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. My name is Scotty, and I tuned in about 5 minutes ago, and I was just reading the show description about decriminalizing you know, the sex industry, and I see many correlations with the so-called war on drugs, and, you know, many are calling for the decriminalization of some of our drug laws, because here we have, you know, we say that this is the land of the free, but yet we have the most incarcerated population of all nations. And, you know, and we're just putting people in prison for what I call victimless crimes. You know, if somebody wants to pay for sex, that's between those two individuals. If somebody wants to smoke some pot or whatever, long as they're not intruding upon another person's liberty or their freedom, I don't see why it's the government's business. And then we have those who want to complain about all the money that the government spends, and, you know, that's a big area where we're spending a lot of money to house prisoners, and we're, again, locking up a lot of nonviolent people because of these ridiculous laws. And I just see the correlation between what your guest is talking about and, you know, with the criminalization of drugs, which actually started under Nixon, is when the war on drugs started.
And Maxine, what are your thoughts on our caller?
Well, we just went and got the endorsement for our signature petition drive from a local group here called the Axis of Love Women's Collective. And that's a collective of cannabis patients who run a cooperative dispensary, who are struggling under the threat of the federal DEA raids on a daily basis to continue to operate, continue to make available medicinal marijuana. We felt it was really important to get that group of people's endorsement because of our shared issues. And so several of those women in that particular collective had been through the PSAGE project, interestingly enough, Jill. And some of the things that I learned from them was that they were seeking out the services that SAGE had to offer in terms of supposedly, you know, job training, supposedly housing, But what didn't work for those women is the fact that they had to be drug tested in order to be there, and they had to be there at least for 6 hours every day to qualify for those services. And they just, you know, if they had to spend 6 hours in one place, they needed to be getting paid to be there. You know what I mean? They didn't need to be giving their free labor and their free time in this SAGE project, this project that's supposed to be helping women, you know, who've been involved in a whole myriad of, you know, things like domestic violence. And so here they're being mandated to give up 6 hours of their day every day when they needed to be actually job searching and actually, you know, having some income. So we just find that this whole, you know, monkey court of the drug courts now, we're seeing all the drug courts, you know, here in California being mandated all this money, you know, all this federal and state money in order to try to divert people out of the court system. But just like I was explaining with the Department of Public Health and the massage ordinance, it's actually just added a whole nother layer of adversity onto a group of people, you know, who just want to use drugs, you know, and they should be allowed to do whatever it is that they want to do. And why the state thinks that they have to, you know, subtract their pound of flesh out of people under the guise of saving them is just complete, you know, it's just extortion. I mean, here in the state of California, we're looking at spending, we're on the cusp of spending more money incarcerating people than we are on education of our youth. And here, the state of California has just issued 5,000 layoff notices to educators across the state, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how much money are we spending on the enforcement of drugs and trying to make people do drugs or not do drugs or punish people for doing drugs and having them go through these little baloney drug courts and, you know, being forced to live in these housing situations? You know, they're supposed to be clean and sober housing situations that the state is subsidizing, right? Just, you know, it's just, the whole thing is just, you know, it's not where the American people want to be spending their money and their time and their resources. And we need to, and that's why we had to take the petition to the streets. We have to take the petition to the people. Because we have to, because the legislators are making bad decision after bad decision, and, you know, to quote a very infamous reverend, those chickens are coming home to roost now. And we are suffering the consequences of those bad legislators' bad decisions, and we don't want to be suffering, you know, what they've decided is okay for us and what's not okay for us. And
you,
we have
you know,
to stop people from this.
You know, the host, Maxine, I'm sorry. Well, you were touching on, I heard you talking about the CIA and some things it was doing in South America. And also in your show description, you talk about political corruption and selective law enforcement. And, you know, I also host a show here on Blog Talk Radio. In the past 2 days, you know, I was exploring the issues that the person you just quoted brought up, and he talked about our government importing drugs. So I did a whole thing on an Iran-Contra scandal, and I provided documentation on my blogs, you know, newspaper articles, books, and magazine articles on this whole thing, and also congressional testimony. But getting back to my point, you know, how hypocritical is it for our government to, through the CIA, to fund their black ops operations to overthrow democratically elected governments and to fund that by allowing drugs to come into our country? You know, you have ex-DEA agents on 60 Minutes back in 1993 saying, you know, that they do it for the money. So, I mean, it's just very hypocritical for our government. And I'm not going to paint, say, everybody in government, but we have agencies in our government who are bringing drugs into our country and then locking up people for selling their products. and using it. It's just so hypocritical, and I get so frustrated.
Well, this is the thing that's so interesting about the Elliot Spritzer case. The hypocrisy is so, so visible, where you have actual elected officials like him who built mm-hmm. their political careers off the backs of prostitutes and off the labor, the criminalized labor of prostitutes, who, you know, turns out to be, you know, a huge, huge whoremonger. And, you know, he has got some bad karma, but it's not only him that has to pay for all the bad things that he has done. It's the whole state of New York. All the people that elected him are going to have to pay now, and they should be paying, and they need to look at the restitution. They need to look at what hypocritical laws they enacted and they allowed their elected officials to enact. And they need to come up with a remedy, which, of course, is decriminalization across the board. Otherwise, you're going to have a corrupt law enforcement. You're going to have corrupt officials. We have a corrupt pseudo-democracy here in the United States. And the Elliot Spritzer case is the epitome of that. And I don't see anybody in the media talking about those elements. You know, the things they're talking about in mainstream media is an example of how the corporate-sponsored media is
right.
only about, you know, running shotgun for the corporately-sponsored decision-makers who want to keep the chokehold on the American people, and it's time for us to say no more.
I guess you could call that selective reporting. And another thing that comes to my mind on the topic of sex workers, okay, so it's illegal for the states and our government has made it illegal for two adults, consenting adults, to strike a contract with each other in exchange of services. Okay, but at the same time, we are the number one producers of porn. I mean, aren't those sex workers, and how come that's legal?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And one of the things that we do here at the Erotic Service Providers Union is we decided to include all people who earn a living from their erotic labor. It's really important for everybody who earns a living from their erotic labor or in support staff service capacity, you know, whether you're the photographer or you're the editor of porn or you're the phone, you know, operator, you're the dispatcher for an escort service. You know, we need to come together as a group and start looking at what things we have in common together and how it is that legislation and regulation of one particular part of the erotic labor ends up being a detrimental effect on the other part, and how it is that we need to mobilize certain groups of erotic laborers. For example, you know, the porn people laid down for that federal bill 2257 a couple years ago that mandated that all web-based porn had to maintain an office hours with signed hard copy paperwork, you know, pieces of trees that included people's real names and their you know, contact information if they decided to pose nude. You know, all that done under the guise of, you know, bringing protection to people under 18. And of course, we don't see protection under 18. We see a whole industry that laid down for some regulation that regulated their end of the business. And now, you know, now we have adult industry workers, you know, the escorts and the online masseuses who advertise are being held to that same standard.
Well,
so,
it's an interesting topic, and you know, thank you for taking my call, and I'll continue to listen.
All right, thank you, caller. You know, an interesting email just came in, Maxine, and it was responding to both you and our other caller. Diana from Portland, Oregon, has written that the average age of entry into prostitution is 13 years old, and that both callers are advocating the trafficking of 13-year-old human beings. What is your response to Diana's email? Diana, I certainly encourage you to call in at 646-200-3136. I personally find that stat to be somewhat hard to fathom. The average age of entry is 13. I don't believe that anyone on this show is advocating a 13-year-old or even a minor be involved in the sex industry or coerced in any way. Maxine, how do you feel about Diana's email, and do you feel that she's perhaps misrepresenting the issue?
So is the concern is, I'm sorry, I had a difficult, hard time hearing exactly what the concern was. Something about the average age of entry into the sex industry is 13 years old?
According to Diana in Portland, Oregon, the average age of entry is 13 years old. Now, perhaps I'm misunderstanding how they're calculating the statistic, but
Well, that's the main thing, Jill, is whenever I see or hear those kinds of statistics reported, my question is always the same. Where is the documentation? Where is the documentation for those statements? You know, we recently here in Oakland had an article written by two writers who talk about child prostitution numbers are up, but the age of prostitutes is down. And when you read through this article, there is no documentation for anything that they are saying. You know, why it is that when workers' experience in the sex industry becomes extrapolated to be the norm for everybody is part of the way that we see the sex-negative, shame-based, anti-prostitutionist want to paint us into a negative light, because they believe that by painting us into this negative, exploitive light, that somehow we'll just dry up and go away, that somehow prostitutes and prostitution and our customers will just some magically, you know, in some magical thinking, cease to exist. And that is just not the case. Prostitution has been criminalized for 100 years. The original prostitution laws that were passed to abate prostitution, to stop prostitution, were all made with these same false statements that had no documentation. And 100 years later, we're still here. And we're going to be here 100 years from now. And the only question for us is, do we want to continue to exist in this same state of coercion and state exploitation? And I don't. You know, I want to do what I can do today to make those changes come about, so that if we have child labor laws that are being violated, we already have child labor laws on the books. We already have child labor laws that say, you know, children are not supposed to be working for a living in order to support themselves, right? We already have those on the books. Yet we see children involved in different industries throughout the globe, and they're being forced to work in order to survive. And what is that about? You know, we have to look at what have we done as a whole global race to bring about these conditions. We are responsible for it. Here in the United States in 1994, we allowed that Republican Congress to come in and pass that contract on America that ended the welfare state. And now all of a sudden we're seeing, you know, supposedly these undocumented numbers of proliferation of child prostitution. I mean, you know, it doesn't make any sense on either end that these numbers are up, that there's no documentation for it, but yet we see a bunch of state funding, federal and state funding, going towards these nonprofits, these supposed experts like Norma Hotaling, who is spewing these falsehoods and so that they can get state money, so that they can get federal money to continue to profit off the poverty, to continue to profit off the criminalization of prostitution, to continue to profit off the criminalization of immigration. And that's what you see here, is that you don't see any workers being empowered. You know, when we see these stories of here in San Francisco, actually it was in Oakland, was a San Francisco police officer caught in a car with a 14-year-old street-based worker that he picked up in Oakland, right? 35-year veteran of the San Francisco police force. Picked up, you know, being caught by the Oakland Police Department in a car with a 14-year-old, paying her $50 for sex. What is a 14-year-old doing on the street in the first place, right? You know, all we can do in this situation is condemn him, condemn her, and what are we doing? You know, we can, you know, get more grants and salaries to these poverty pimp groups who are supposedly providing charity services on the back end here. That's not what we want to be doing as a society. We've got it all wrong, and we've got it all backwards, and arresting consensually working prostitutes does not stop exploitation of children, period.
You know, and this all falls under, the irony of it strikes me, you know, with this grand Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, you know, all this federal money is going specifically to these specific anti-prostitution organizations, only ones that will take the anti-prostitution pledge. And yet the numbers are going, at the same time, they're stating the numbers of childhood prostitution, the numbers of those being exploited are going up. The age is going down, which would indicate to me clearly their war on trafficking and the conflation of human trafficking with all forms of erotic labor. This clearly is not working.
Yes.
You know, we see articles by the mainstream media, and nowhere are sex workers' voices or sex worker rights voices being brought into the discussion. The only sex workers that you see tend to be ones that come from the perspective that supports the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, or if you get the sex worker who states she likes her job and she's not being exploited, she gets badgered by the host, invalidated. This is all a giant business, and I completely agree with you, and I think we need to get the message out, how can people help you out in California?
Well, what we're looking at is getting groups to and people to write letters to senators and, you know, U.S. House of Representatives members and, you know, telling them that they have to put actual sex industry workers at the center of any discussions around us. You know, that's what we want to do as a labor organization, is we always want to bring the workers' voices to the center. The TVPRA, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, is just such a tool of evil, you know, brought by, you know, these sex worker, anti-sex women who, you know, are aligned with the religious right, the fanatical religious right to stop, you know, people from having sex. I mean, that's their goal, is, you know, they think that somehow being paid for sex and classifying all commercial sex as trafficking is going to improve our lives, our customers' lives, and everybody else's lives, and they are completely wrong about that. And, you know, part of our corrupt system is that you have these legislatures, these, you know, seemingly do-gooder legislatures who are jumping on the bandwagon of, you know, stopping forced labor. And really what they're doing is they continue to scapegoat us. They continue to take our voices and usurp our voices and speak for us without really ever having to have a conversation with us. And so those are the things that I'm doing, is making all the groups that I'm a part of, you know, write letters to, you know, people like Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, our senators, and tell them, you know, do not pass that horrible legislation you know, without having my voice in Congress. My voice has to be heard. And that's what we want to really demand.
Maxine, we have 5 minutes left. How can someone find you or find your organization to support you?
Yeah, we have our website. It's ESPU, which stands for the Erotic Service Providers Union. It's espu-ca.org. It's a blog. You know, my webmaster set it up for us as a blog so that I can go in there and add stuff as I want to, and people are welcome to blog on. We have copies of the petition that's there. We have our little state campaign committee set up, Committee United for Safety and Protection. You know, we can receive donations. We need to raise some money here to help get our campaign, keep it going, and get this ballot initiative qualified to get put in front of the voters here in San Francisco. It's important to do that, because if we can free San Francisco, we can go on and free the state of California, and we can go on and free the state of New York, and we can go on and free the nation of all these sex-negative, hypocritical laws that, just basically end up funding, you know, the poverty pimps like Namaho Tallinn. And so you can find us online at espu-ca.org, and, you know, the email address is on there. You can always info@espu. At Bound Together Bookstore over in the Hate, the movie Legalization Sucks is available for purchase over there if you're local in San Francisco.
So other sex worker rights groups have joined in. I can speak for Sex Workers Outreach Project East, who has endorsed the work that you're doing in California. Do you see forward progress?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we're starting to see some unity here amongst the sex workers and the sex worker groups, and everybody is being given an opportunity, you know, to sign on and endorse the petition and participate on the committee. And it's a great, you know, it's what has to be done. It's the kind of organizing, political organizing, that we have to be doing. You know, this is sex worker rights boot camp here. Anybody wants to come to California and, you know, find out how it is that we do it, come on down.
We have approximately 1 minute remaining. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with me?
I just really appreciate you, Jill. I really appreciate all the hard work that you do, and you do a lot of advocacy, and you do a lot of great work, and we loved having you out here, and we look forward to having you out here again.
I certainly look forward to a return to California. I had a brief discussion in Greensboro, North Carolina, and was advised that there is no prostitution in Greensboro. Oops, my audio producer is advising me that we have 90 seconds. I was advised by the Greensboro Police Department that there was no need for any type of sex worker rights advocacy because there are no sex workers.
That's what the devil likes to tell you, that he doesn't exist, huh? The police are telling you, oh, no, we don't arrest people for prostitution here.
there is no sex work. There is no prostitution in Guilford County, North Carolina. They've declared it a prostitution-free zone, and apparently they've had great success, according to according to Officer Draper, let's just say. But let's give him his moment of fame. We are running out of time. I want to thank Maxine Dugan for joining us today. She was a great guest with some fantastic information. Once again, please check out her website. You can find more information about her through her website or through SWOPE's website, SWOPEast.org. This is XBN, the Sex Workers Broadcast Network, a service Swap East, Sex Workers Outreach Project East. It's powered by Blog Talk Radio. My name is Jill Brenneman, and thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank Native Heroes for your support. Maxine, do I still have you? No, I'm not.